Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And now we continue our 30 issues election series with issue 26. How many immigrants and who and why? Let's listen to some history.
Where are you going? Chicago, in America.
Chicago, America? We are going to New York, America. We'll be neighbors.
Okay, it's fictionalized history via Fiddler on the Roof, that scene with East European Jews Tevye and Lazar about to come to America was set in 1905. In real life, about 2 to 3 million European Jews came to the U.S. between around 1880 and the start of World War I. They were part of around 20 million total immigrants who came in through New York City from the 1850s to the early 1920s, first through Castle Garden in Manhattan, also known as Castle Clinton, and then through Ellis Island from 1892 until the 1940s, according to History.com. Even today, 40% of Americans might have ancestors who came in through Ellis Island. The first broadly restrictive immigration laws were passed in 1917 and 1924, establishing quotas for people from various European nations and virtually banning immigration from Asia. Why that first real immigration backlash a century ago next year? We'll talk about it with immigration historian Tom Gelton coming up. Those European quotas were still in effect in the 1960s when President John Kennedy argued for relaxing the numerical restrictions to allow siblings of immigrants to join their families here.
There are still a good many brothers and sisters of American citizens who are unable to get here, who may have preferences as members of families, but because of the maldistribution of quotas in the European area, we have this situation which has become nearly intolerable.
John Kennedy as president, as the national origin quotas were falling into disfavor. After Kennedy's death, President Johnson continued the fight.
A nation that was built by the immigrants of all lands can ask those who now seek admission, what can you do for our country? But we should not be asking, in what country were you born?
That was LBJ, and how different from today with the Trump proposal to ban all immigration from specific countries that he says nobody can be vetted from. But before Congress passed that Immigration Reform Act of 1965, sometimes known as the Brothers and Sisters Act, as Kennedy referred to it there, because it gave preference to immediate family members of people here. But before it was passed, skeptics raised concerns that it would let in too many people from too many places and the ethnic makeup of the country would change too much for some people's comfort level. Here is a reenactment of a conversation between one of those skeptics, North Carolina Senator Sam Ervin, and then Secretary of State Dean Rusk, defending the bill as not threatening too much change. Ervin expresses concern, for example, about too many people from India.
You have in India a lot of people who would like to get into this country, do you not?
We don't have a long waiting list.
It is because they haven't been able to get in. Even with a bleak opportunity to get in as they have 150 applications for every visa that could be issued.
Yes, the present estimate, based upon the best information we can get, is there might be, say, 8,000 immigrants from India in the next 5 years. In other words, I don't think we have a particular picture of a world situation where everybody is just straining to move to the United States.
A reenactment of a real exchange between Senator Ervin and Secretary of State Rusk in the early 1960s. But if the estimate in that clip was just 8,000 Indian immigrants over the next 5 years, well, here are the real numbers. The Indian American population was just 200,000 in 1980. Today, it's over 2 million, the second largest immigrant population behind Mexicans, according to migrationpolicy.org, and just ahead of Chinese. The Brothers and Sisters Act and later laws with preferences for skilled immigrants gave Indian immigration that boost. But when President Johnson signed the Immigration and Nationality Act, ending the national quotas in 1965, he was still downplaying the impact that it would likely have.
This bill that we will sign today is not a revolutionary bill. It does not affect the lives of millions. It will not reshape the structure of our daily lives or really add importantly to either our wealth or our power.
When the law took effect, just 4% of the U.S. population was foreign-born. Today, it's about 13%. Of today's foreign-born Americans, nearly 30% are from Mexico, the next largest, Indian, at about 5%, and China around the same, according to migrationpolicy.org. The explosion of the Mexican population led to a backlash by the 1980s and calls for a crackdown on those coming illegally. But here's an indication of how much has changed. Here's the iconic conservative president Ronald Reagan in a 1984 campaign debate against Democrat Walter Mondale. It's Reagan advocating amnesty.
I believe in the idea of amnesty for those who have put down roots and who have lived here, even though sometime back they may have entered illegally.
A 1986 immigration reform signed by Reagan gave amnesty to millions of Mexicans and others here illegally while trying to crack down on future illegal immigration by enforcement through the workplace. Employers would need documentation of legal residency status to a greater degree than before. Reagan, in fact, was practically an open borders guy. Here's 30 seconds of his farewell address in 1989. Listen to this language.
I've spoken of the shining city all my political life, but I don't know if I ever quite communicated what I saw when I said it. But in my mind, it was a tall, proud city built on rocks stronger than oceans, windswept, God-blessed, and teeming with people of all kinds living in harmony and peace. A city with pre-ports that hummed with commerce and creativity. And if there had to be city walls, the walls had doors, and the doors were open to anyone with the will and the heart to get here.
Hello, Donald Trump. If the city had to have walls, the walls had doors, and they would open to anyone with the willingness and the heart to get here. Reagan in 1989. But the backlash continued. President Bill Clinton commissioned an immigration report. Lead writer, the legendary African-American Congresswoman Barbara Jordan from Texas, who warned that too much legal and illegal immigration was depressing low-skill wages. She recommended better border enforcement and a one-third reduction in legal immigration. Clinton resisted that reduction, but responded on the border.
After years of neglect, this administration has taken a strong stand to stiffen the protection of our borders. We are increasing border controls by 50%. We are increasing inspections to prevent the hiring of illegal immigrants. And tonight I announce I will sign an executive order to deny federal contracts to businesses that hire illegal immigrants. Let me be very clear about this. We are still a nation of immigrants. We should be proud of it. We should honor every legal immigrant here working hard to be a good citizen, working hard to become a new citizen. But we are also a nation of laws.
Whatever Clinton did wasn't enough to stop the flow of immigrants and the backlash. In 2000, Pat Buchanan, who had worked for Reagan and Nixon and was a precursor to the Trump campaign of today, ran in the Republican primaries, sounding this racially tinged alarm about the multicultural future of this country at present immigration rates.
Now, none of us are true universalists. We feel responsibility for others because we share with them common bonds, common history, a common fate. When these are gone, America will be a far harsher place. That is why I am proposing immigration reform to make it possible to more fully assimilate the 30 million immigrants who have arrived in the last 30 years. As president, I will ask Congress to reduce new entry visas to 250,000 to 300,000 a year, which will be enough to admit family members of new citizens with plenty of immediate family members, with plenty of room for the many thousands with the special talents or skills our society needs.
Pat Buchanan in 2000, as you heard there, he wanted no more than 300,000 legal immigrants a year. The number last year was about 1.3 million, according to migrationpolicy.org, with an estimated 42 million Americans here today, born abroad, and an estimated 11 million of them here illegally. We have the current competing pressures for border enforcement and deportation on the one hand, legalization of those who are living here as Americans on the other. The issues have divided the Republican Party, as evidenced by the Trump campaign on one side, people like Arizona Senator John McCain on the other.
We have been too content for too long to allow individuals to mow our lawn, serve our food, clean our homes, and even watch our children, while not affording them any of the benefits that make our country so great.
McCain in 2013. Democrats have tried to compromise with the harder line Republicans in pursuit of a path to citizenship, or at least regularization of the 11 million or so. We heard how Clinton increased border resources. It happened again under Bush. Obama even stepped up deportations of those deemed criminal, leading to big protests like this one from the so-called Dreamer generation, young adults brought here illegally as kids, but who have grown up American. This from 2014 in Santa Fe. President Obama was sometimes pretty unpopular in Latino communities and had a nickname, the Deporter in Chief. And Obama was completely stymied and frustrated by the Republican Congress. He took that justice for families that we heard in that chant into his own hands with his executive actions, exempting first Dreamers and then parents of Dreamers from deportation with a signature on his piece of paper with his pen.
So we're going to offer the following deal. If you've been in America for more than 5 years, if you have children who are American citizens or legal residents, if you register, pass a criminal background check, and you're willing to pay your fair share of taxes, you'll be able to apply to stay in this country temporarily without fear of deportation. You can come out of the shadows and get right with the law.
The Supreme Court this year blocked the deportation protection for the parents of Dreamers. People like former House Speaker John Boehner supported that decision because Obama acted on his own.
Instead of working together to fix our broken immigration system, the president says he's acting on his own. That's just not how our democracy works. The president had said before that he's not king and he's not an emperor, but he's sure acting like one. And he's doing it at a time when the American people want nothing more than for us to work together.
And that is a brief audio history of some immigration politics in our 30 Issues election series, Issue 26, How Many Immigrants and Who and Why. And with me now to talk about it for a few minutes is NPR religion correspondent Tom Gelton. He's author of the book that came out last year, A Nation of Nations, A Great American Immigration Story. Tom, welcome back to WNYC.
Good to be back, Brian, and let me congratulate you on that excellent summary of U.S. immigration legislation and policy over the last 100 years.
Thank you so much. And I even want to go back further with you. I don't know how far back your book goes, honestly, but until 1820 or so, nobody checked anything, if I'm not mistaken. If you could get here by boat, you just got off the boat and came in. What led to the first immigration laws of any kind?
Well, the very first immigration law, Brian, was actually passed in 1792, and it limited citizenship to, free, quote, free white persons. So even though there were no no border controls as such. There was a law that certainly defined what it was required to be a U.S. citizen, and that effectively excluded people of color. You said if you could get on a boat. I mean, the truth of the matter is that global transportation, global communication was very different in those days from what it is now, and there weren't a lot of opportunities for people from Africa or Asia to get on boats to come over here. So, you know, that was kind of moot. And then what happened, the first really big immigration restriction came in the middle of the 19th century. There were a lot of male Chinese who were imported here to work as laborers, first on the Transcontinental Railroad and then in mines, particularly in the West, some in agricultural fields. They mostly came, they didn't really come as immigrants. They came as laborers. They did not bring their families. They intended to go back. They sent their money back home. But there was a backlash against them. And in the latter, in around 1882, there was a Chinese Exclusion Act that effectively excluded Chinese from immigrating legally to the United States and becoming citizens. That was the first major immigration restriction legislation.
And what were those national quota laws in 1917 and 1924? Right. Was there an ethnic backlash to the Ellis Island era?
Absolutely. Because as you pointed out at the beginning of your summary, around 1880 or so, there was a shift in the pattern of immigration to the United States. Up until then, it had primarily been coming from Northern and Western Europe. Beginning around that time, you saw a lot more Southern Europeans coming, Italians, for example, and Eastern Europeans, including large numbers of Jews. And there was a fundamentally racist idea that some nationalities were superior to others, that assimilated better. There was actually a commission called the Dillingham Commission, named after a Republican senator from Vermont, Senator Dillingham, who studied immigration to the United States. And they came out with this encyclopedia of races and people where they made generalizations about different nationalities. Mm. And they basically said that Northern and Western Europeans were superior and made better Americans, and that Southern and Eastern Europeans were inferior and had a harder time assimilating. And it was on the basis largely of that report and similar thinking that these national origin quotas were put in place. And there was actually a formula behind them, which was that the backers of those quotas wanted the U.S. population mix of 1890 to be maintained. So even though this was now 30 years later, they wanted to go back to whatever the U.S. ethnic mix was in 1890 and keep that maintained for years going forward.
And it certainly shines a light on our notions of race today if what you're describing is notions of different races ranked by superiority and inferiority in 1917, 1924, and they were all European. Today, all those people are lumped in as white.
That's right. You know, it's interesting. Nobody questions, you know, the assimilability of Italians or Slavs today.
Right.
At that time, and even as late as 1965, when the national origin quotas were removed, the big issue was, you know, what do we do about all these Slavs and Italians, Mediterranean types who want to come here? Nobody was, even in 1965, nobody was talking about, well, this discriminates against Africans. This discriminates against Asians. You know, that was kind of a secondary issue, and it was not an issue in the early part of the 20th century. The controversy was really around Southern and Eastern Europeans.
Am I right that those laws limited immigration from Europe severely, as we just discussed, banned it entirely from Asia, but also did not limit it from the Western Hemisphere at all?
Well, yeah, partly. I mean, there were 100 visa slots reserved for countries in Asia, countries in Africa, countries in the Middle East, for example. So it was not entirely, but for all practical purposes, you're right, that was ended. There was no quota system set up for the Western Hemisphere. However, there was the immigration from the Western Hemisphere was limited by another provision in immigration legislation, legislation, which was that if you were likely to become a public charge, you could not come to the United States. You had to prove that you would not be a welfare burden. And that was actually, for many people in Latin America, that was actually an even bigger obstacle than the quotas. It was very hard to prove that you would not be a public charge. And after 1965, when family unification, the right to immigrate by virtue of being a relative of somebody who was already here, when that was instituted, that opened up a new avenue for people from Latin America. It allowed them to sort of bypass, get around this likely to become a public charge issue. And that's the reason that the 65 Act opened the door to a lot of immigration from the Western Hemisphere, even though there had not been a quota previously limiting immigration from there.
So interesting. And that 1965 Immigration and Nationality Act, which is still the controlling immigration law today, more or less, the audio history we heard suggests the proponents either were really caught by surprise by the massive numbers of immigrants who came from Latin America and the Caribbean and Asia as a result of those family unification provisions, either really surprised or they were playing possum a little during the congressional debate in the early 60s. Have you studied this?
Yeah, there's actually both the supporters and the critics of this reform were surprised for different reasons. I think that one of the most, you could say naive comments was the one that you had from Dean Rusk saying that it was not true that there are great numbers of people straining to come to the United States. Of course, there were great numbers of people straining to come to the United States. The middle 1960s were a period of violent conflict in much of Africa and Southeast Asia. Decolonization was taking place. Improvements in global communication and transportation were making it possible for people to migrate. So that was really a foolish statement on his part. On the part of the opponents, there was another miscalculation. And this is really interesting, and it's one that's not often known. The quote from President Johnson that you had was that people should be judged on the basis of what they could do for our country. There was a fear that if you opened the doors to people coming on that basis, you would get a lot of people of color. And instead, the chairman of the House Immigration Subcommittee substituted family unification rather than contribution as the main criterion. And the idea was that if you gave priority to people who already had relatives here, you would basically get the same kind of population that you already had, because there weren't a lot of Asians living here. There weren't a lot of Africans. So if you gave priority to relatives, you would just get more Europeans. Mm-hmm. Well, it didn't work out that way. And in fact, once you let in just a few Asians or Africans or Middle Easterners,
Latin Americans,
you opened up the door to their family members. And it's that family unification provision that has really accounted for the vast, vast majority of immigrants from non-European countries in the last 50 years.
But that Johnson quote, that part of the Johnson quote you cite, judging people not where they come from, but what they could do for our country, raises a whole other portion of the immigration debate, which we barely touched on. We'll do more of this with other guests tomorrow as part of this series. But the question is, what is immigration for? Is it for meeting the needs of the United States in terms of workforce needs and particular skills needs and things like that? Is it just what's inscribed at the base of the Statue of Liberty? Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free. In other words, it's for the benefit of them, because that's what America is about at the values level. And don't worry, we can assimilate anybody who comes here who's tired and poor but yearning to breathe free, or some combination. I mean, it's a subtext of the debate that goes on today without, I think, being addressed explicitly all that much.
You know what? And it's a huge issue. It's not addressed all that much. But you might recall that when immigration reform, the so-called Gang of Eight bill, was moving through Congress, that issue was addressed. And there was a move to limit the family unification provisions, which were accounting for so much of the immigration, and sort of boost the the alternative provision, which was to give priority to people whose skills were advantageous to the United States. So that's going to come back. I mean, the Brothers and Sisters, you mentioned the Brothers and Sisters Act. That's the single most controversial aspect of the family unification provision. Do we really, should we really be giving priority to the brothers and sisters of adult U.S., the adult brothers and sisters of U.S. citizens? That's really, that is a questionable provision. And even people who are sympathetic to immigrants are willing to consider some modification of that provision. So I would predict that if we ever get around to debating immigration policy and immigration laws again, I'm confident that that issue will come back.
Let me touch a couple of things more with you briefly before we run out of time. My guest, NPR's Tom Gelton, author of A Nation of Nations, A Great American Immigration Story, as we talk about immigration history as part of our 30 Issues series, Issue 26, How Much Immigration and Who and Why. And we will continue tomorrow with a debate among two between two other guests on what our immigration laws should be going forward. But to touch a couple of more pieces of history, why was Reagan for amnesty and subsequent Republicans have made it such a dirty word?
Well, this goes back, in the 1980 election, President Reagan got a fairly high percentage of Hispanic votes. I mean, there's a myth that the immigrant vote has always been allied exclusively with Democrats and against Republicans. I mean, there are a lot of features of Republican orthodoxy that actually appeal to immigrants. And Ronald Reagan was not known for being sort of anti-immigrant. Back in 1965, the 65 Immigration Act got a higher percentage of votes from the Republican caucus than it did from the Democratic caucus. So this idea that this has always been a Democratic issue is just a myth.
Democrats opposed? Were they the Dixiecrats, the same people who were for segregation?
Exactly. And I mean, so the Democratic Party and the Republican Party were very different back then. You had this Northeastern, moderate Republicans were in the leadership positions of the Republican Party. And meanwhile, the Southern Democrats dominated the Democratic Party. So it was a very different party lineup. So just the country, the political affiliations have just sort of shifted over the years. That's the only explanation I can give, Brian.
And my last question is to get your take on why illegal immigration is always at the fulcrum of the debate. I think that illegal immigration is kind of a proxy for pure numbers. And it's not even so much that, people think if we don't have laws, we don't have a country, as Donald Trump put it. Sure, a country has the right to enforce its borders and to decide how many immigrants it takes in. But the focus on the illegality of the status of some of the immigrants here, I think, is just a proxy for what we heard from Pat Buchanan in that clip from 2000, that there are a lot of mostly white Americans who think that there are just too many immigrants here and the fabric of the nation is going to change. The economic prosperity of the nation is going to be threatened with too many poor people or too many people who don't have what they might think is a European work ethic or whatever goes through people's minds, but that the illegal immigration focus is really a proxy for the pure numbers, even though we don't talk about the pure numbers very much.
Well, Not so much anymore. Donald Trump has changed this. I mean, if you look carefully at his immigration speech in Phoenix, he was actually talking a lot about changing legal immigration. I mean, I think he sort of alone among these among Republican politicians in recent years has really raised the question of legal immigration. I mean, if you look at that speech, he even seemed in some ways to be questioning the premises of the 1965 Act. He actually called for an immigration policy where you would have a population share based on, his words, historical norms. That goes all the way back to the arguments for the national origin quotas back in 1924. So, I actually think that even though you're right, he does talk about illegal immigrants a lot, he also talks about changing U.S. policy with regard to who is allowed to come in.
Whoops. I think we just lost Tom Gelton's line because it just turned exactly 11 o'clock. We must have had a rental on a really good line, what they call an ISDN line. And poof, it went away at the stroke 11 o'clock So we thank Tom Gelton, NPR religion correspondent. Luckily, we were at the end of our conversation anyway, and I think you understood his last answer. He's the author of the book, A Nation of Nations, A Great American Immigration Story, published last year by Simon & Schuster. And that's today's installment in our week-long issue 26 in our 30 issues election series, How Many Immigrants and Whom and For What? And we will continue tomorrow with a debate on some of these issues.